Welcome back to Star Trek Discovery Pod. My name is Mike Moody, and this is a Patreon preview episode of the podcast, which you can listen to in full by signing up at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. You can sign up at the $1 level to get the bonus content, and at the $2 level for the bonus content plus an invite to our Slack community, where you can hang with other Star Trek fans, get access to live watch parties, all kinds of cool stuff happening there. We also have a $5 tier that gets you all of that, plus a few more bonus gifts. So please join us at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. You can also visit our podcast website to get all the free episodes of the podcast at StarTrekPod.co. We really appreciate you listening and supporting us on Patreon. It's a great way to help us continue to produce the pod. And here's a preview of our podcast about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Enjoy. All right, let's go in first.
I can go because this is my favorite of the original series Star Trek movies. I think it is premium 1986 film content. I was looking at some of the other movies that came out this year, and it's like Ferris Bueller, Big Trouble in Little China, The Golden Child, Little Shop of Horrors, and this one. And I think it fits into that feeling of like, you're going to the movies to have a good time. You're going to eat a bucket of popcorn. You're going to enjoy the plot, but you don't have to think about it too much. And there's enough great one-liners that you can say them to all your friends when you go home later. So I think it's a great movie in that it balances all of that kind of feeling of being that popcorn cult classic movie plus still being Star Trek and still being the characters that we've loved from the original series. I like that everyone gets their moment in this movie. And it's less about the sort of big three, if you will, and you get a little bit of everybody. And it's like a whale heist movie. What's not to love?
Yeah, this is such a joyful movie. If it doesn't put a smile on your face, you're just like an old angry Klingon. I love this movie. Big surprise, right? But not only because it's so fun, but also because it does something that all the other Star Trek movies didn't do. It makes Star Trek very accessible to the general audiences without sacrificing what Star Trek is all about. It really encapsulates what Star Trek is all about. Like the franchise core values of like responsibility and exploration and accountability and preservation of life really drive this movie. And I think that good-natured engine is a big part of what makes people connect to the movie. And it's really funny. The comedy feels effortless and breezy. Like, the stakes are so high. Like, literally, Earth is going to blow up or whatever if they don't get these whales back. But it all feels like real breezy and real, you know, effortless. It's super charming. Yes, there is an easily digestible parable about biological conservation. I don't think it gets too preachy. It's just a great time. I love this movie.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. This was a little bit unexpected to me. I mean, I think that right before I watched it, Mike, you described it as basically a Muppet movie. And yeah, this is it's wacky. It's playful. It's for the most part pretty lighthearted, and despite what the stakes are, you don't get that sense of urgency really in the movie so much as you get them playing around with this juxtaposition of what if a future society crashed with our current contemporary society, and what's the commentary on the problems of modern society. It was a lot of fun, and it's really interesting. I'm fascinated to hear some more of the behind the scenes aspects of this, because like you're saying, Mariah, this came out in 1986, and there was a little bit of this escapism, like kind of feel good escapism going on as a little bit more of a trend in the movies. You're not trying to be as aggressive necessarily or frightening so much as you just want some fun popcorn movies. And I wonder if that's a little bit in response to the overall social anxiety going on with something like the Cold War. And I think that's pretty much reflected as well in Watchmen. I mean, I did a podcast talking about the Watchmen comic book and then the movie, and that comic book came out in 86 or 85 to 86, right at the height of the tension as well. And like, there's this national anxiety about all of that. So now, like, thinking about that context of this movie coming out and thinking about Chekhov talking about needing the nuclear vessels, I'm curious how that played with an audience that might have had a little bit of an anti-Russian sentiment. Like what is, like, how do I understand how that was accepted?
I think the movie smartly, you know, they put that into the movie in a smart way, you know, but it's still, it's like, oh, he's a Russian, we got to take care of him when the naval ship finds him, and he's right. Yeah, but it's funny.
It is, yeah. And I wonder if that was a way of smartly trying, like Star Trek making their point of trying to ease tensions as far as like this sort of xenophobia about Russians.
Yeah. In TOS, we know Chekhov didn't show up in the original series until season 2. And it was partly because Gene Roddenberry wanted a European type who looked similar to Davy Jones from the Monkees on the show. So, but they made him Russian because I believe it was one of the leaders of Russia who criticized Star Trek for not having a Russian character.
Oh, I mean, I would imagine, like, with the space race and how instrumental Russia was to not have a presence at that point, was kind of like, what are you doing?
So they hired Walter Koenig, who was short and kind of funny looking and had a mop top. So it's like, okay, we get the Russian Davy Jones.
That's perfect.
Well, you want to hear some more of the facts? I'll do my shit I stole from memory alpha segment.
Fun facts.
There's some interesting facts in this about this movie. Of course, the first thing we see on screen is the dedication to the men and women of the spaceship Challenger,
right,
which exploded shortly after liftoff on that year, January 28th. Like, 8 months before this movie came out.
Serious times.
Yeah.
I mean, here we are sitting in quarantine during the COVID crisis. But sometimes you kind of think back about other time periods and like how it might have been a little bit scarier than,
yeah,
you know.
Mm-hmm. I remember watching that in grade school, like live.
It was right.
Quite a shock. Prior to the release of J.J. Abrams' 2009 Star Trek, The Voyage Home was the highest grossing Trek movie. It made $109.7 million in the U.S. That's not even the international figures.
It's impressive.
And the others made, the ones before it made about 70, 80 million.
It also had a much bigger budget as well,
yes,
going into it.
You can tell too. This had a much bigger budget. I didn't get the numbers for the budget, but it was probably double Wrath of Khan.
I think I looked it up. That I think they had like 25 million more than Wrath of Khan or something like that.
The punk in that scene where Spock does a Vulcan neck pinch on the punk, he was a key grip in the movie and they needed a punk. So they used him and he wrote the song that he's playing and recorded it. And after that, they gave him a bunch of other responsibilities because they just figured out that he was a really just a go-getter. And so he got a producer credit on the movie of all
nice
the shit.
Nice job, little punk.
Yeah, not bad for a punk. Due to the massive success of this film, Paramount decided to make another Star Trek TV series, The Next Generation, which premiered the next fall.
Really? TNG started in 87?
Yeah, I guess so. I thought it was 89, but apparently it was 87.
Wow.
The first VHS release of this movie had a promo clip for TNG, and everybody freaked out about it. Okay, this is a fun one. So Catherine Hicks, who plays the whale expert, Gillian Taylor, was originally scripted as a male character, was going to be a wacky college professor who was a UFO nut.
And who also falls in love with Kirk.
I like that she doesn't fall in love with Kirk, actually. At the end, he's like, give me your number. She's like, nah.
I'll find you.
I'll see you around. It was written as a male wacky college professor and UFO nut because Eddie Murphy was in talks to take on the role.
Whoa. Different movie. Mm-hmm. Completely.
Nimoy and Hart Bennett had lots of talks with Murphy. In Shatner's book, Star Trek Movie Memories, he says that Eddie Murphy was a huge Star Trek fan and really wanted a part in the next movie after part three. But he wanted to play either a Starfleet officer or an alien. He wasn't too excited about the idea of playing just like a guy in the 80s. And they knew they needed a main character who, you know, was from the 80s to kind of ground people. And they wanted him to play that, and he didn't want to play that, and they just couldn't make it work. So he decided to go do The Golden Child instead.
Which is fun.
Yeah, not a bad call, I guess.
Mm-mm. Well, The Golden Child critically panned pretty bad. Well, this movie was praised, and I think this movie made more money. And Eddie publicly admitted that he wished that he'd gone with Star Trek IV instead.
It was a bad call then. I take that part.
You don't know what you're talking about. An early draft of the script had Sulu meeting a young kid on the street of San Francisco who turns out to be his ancestor. And they actually filmed that. But they didn't like any of the cuts because the little kid, every time they turned on the cameras, would start freaking out and crying.
No.
And they just could not get to the scene, so they just cut it. And apparently George Takei was really bummed about that. Yeah, so early drafts of the script had Savick remaining on Vulcan, not just because she's boring, but because she was supposed to be pregnant with Spock's child. I think we talked about this in our review of part three.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad they didn't do that because it was already awkward enough to watch them finger bang each other.
Yeah. Oh, the scene where Uhura and Chekhov are like on the streets and they're trying to ask people, where do they get the nuclear vessels in Alameda?
In Alameda.
And there's that one person who's like, I think it's in Alameda. That's what I said, Alameda. That person was not, those extras were not supposed to talk to them because they didn't want to pay them extra, but that person broke the rules. But the scene ended up being, they liked the scene, and I think it's a fun moment. So they had to, to pay her extra, and all the other extras were pissed off.
Especially because that cop was just like staring them down. I was like, it's weird that the cop isn't saying anything.
He's just like staring at him. Yeah, and like today's context, I'm like, you guys better run. Like, this cop does not like you. Not
maniac cop. He's just going to murder you.
Oh, yeah. The slingshot effect used to time travel was previously used in two TOS episodes, Tomorrow is Yesterday and Assignment Earth. And Kirk actually references these events when he says, we've done it before. And I kind of love that they don't really go into the details of how they're going to do it. They just decide to slingshot across the sun because they've done it before. And to have this weird like LSD trip scene.
Oh my God, it was so fun.
Okay. Yeah, Grant, what did you think about that scene?
It was, I mean, now in context, it feels almost out of place. It was very bizarre, like the white heads morphing into each other scene. And I'm like, what am I seeing?
Yeah. You're seeing what Leonard Nimoy sees when he closes his eyes after doing microdoses.
Okay.